All right, let's call this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Please let the record reflect that it is 3:31 p.m. on Thursday, September 9th, 2021. Also, that we have a quorum present today are Senators Stevens, Von Imhoff, Keel, Machicki, and myself, Senator Rivak. I believe Senators Kawasaki and Bishop are on their way. I'd like to also recognize Representatives McKay and Representative Kronk. Thank you for joining us here today. Please silence your cell phones. Staffing the committee today are my aide, Dirk Kraft, LIO moderator, Kelsey Riker, and Carrie Cooper Ryder from Records. Thanks to you all for all you do. Today we'll have a presentation from Gaffney Klein and Associates on recent trends in oil and gas and Alaska's competitiveness in the marketplace. The presentation is about 20 pages. It's the only item on our agenda today. Do we have Mike online? Is our brief at ease? Okay, we're back on the record. Mike, I see you're online. Thanks for being here. I think we'll just jump right into it. So please, sir, if you could put yourself on the record and begin.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Michael with Gaffney Klein Associates. I'm in the Corporate and Strategy Group of Gaffney Klein and Associates, and I'm based in London. And I'm very pleased with you to be with you today. If it's okay, I'll share the presentation.
Yes, please please do, sir. Mike, we have the presentation here. If you just want to walk through it and notify us, we'll flip through the slides for you.
Okay. Is that what's projected behind you?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Okay. It's a little bit harder for me to see, but okay. Let's move, if we can, to the agenda items. Okay, so for today, we're going to really just talk about three main things: some background discussion about the oil and gas industry today, and some of the key developments that we're seeing there that are impactful on Alaska and other resource owners. Then we'll go more specifically and look at Alaska in the global context, and then we'll conclude with some considerations on tax policy. So let's move, if we can, to the first slide titled Volatility and Disruption in the Oil and Gas Industry.
Okay.
All right. Much of this I know is well known by everybody, but the oil and gas industry, of course, has been really hammered by some very disruptive events in recent years. the price collapse of 2014, 2016, the COVID-19 pandemic, and the emergence of alternative energy platforms as a significant and viable thing. And all that is meant for what we all begin to see is a changing long-term prospect for the industry. And during this time, of course, oil and gas companies have performed quite poorly. And this has meant quite a bit of dissatisfaction by investors and the financial institutions that follow them, who've demanded much better financial performance. And at the same time, they're demanding action on energy transition type issues. So they've got these two, and arguably not necessarily equally balanced issues to deal with. All of this has led to divestments and restructurings. These are widespread throughout the industry, and they're occurring, and they will continue for some time. It's led to a renewed focus on capital discipline and investor returns by companies, which has meant in practice that companies are becoming very selective about the projects they do, and they're doing fewer projects. And when they do consider projects, it's with a laser focus on, does it meet their strategic requirements, and are these core assets for them? Resource owners like Alaska are having to work pretty hard to attract companies and capital to their resources. And for governments and states, lower prices and the decelerating demand caused by all these forces has meant that there's been reduced tax revenues as a feature, and tax receipts, and in many cases a contraction of the tax base. If we can move to the next slide, this is a kind of a visual representation of it, which I think may be a little bit helpful. And it takes us from 2000 up to the present date. And the choppiness shows the volatility that we've been talking about of the price volatility. And we can see here, if you look at towards the right-hand third of the chart, we can see that in 2015, 2016, we had a big fall, and I think it's really mainly supply driven. You had OPEC, maintaining their production levels. Meanwhile, you had shale oil becoming quite dominant in the U.S. And global and growing inventories of crude oil around the world, all at the same time with the weakening economy. Just a number of demand type supply type influences that were really driving things down. Just before moving on, of course, at this time we began to see the impact that the tight oil, the shale revolution in the lower 48 was having. The production was really quite high. The U.S. was becoming a net exporter, and everyone around the world, from the big Middle Eastern producers, and I'm sure to some extent in Alaska, was looking at that and seeing that it was really, really a game changer for oil producers. And then, of course, we came to COVID-19, which was a shock, I think, to everybody, and a shock not only because of the human tragedy involved, but also because I think people maybe didn't expect the widespread economic dislocation that it caused. Of course, that was Mother Nature having her moment, But also we had human nature going at the same time, because Saudi Arabia and Russia and other OPEC countries picked a particularly poor time to have a bun fight. And that really exaggerated and added to all the woes that were felt in the oil and gas industry. And of course, as is indicated at the bottom of that little box, the financial industry, banks and lenders and investors, really beginning to take a second look at how they were approaching the oil and gas business, and were beginning to tighten up and approach things differently. Mainly, I think, as a result of concerns about financial performance. But also increasing in the dialogue was issues of energy transition. We'll talk about all those things as we go down the presentation. So if we could just move to the next slide, which is called Energy Transition and Oil and Gas. Okay, so we've mentioned that energy transition has become a kind of a big point, a big issue in the oil and gas industry. It seems quite recent, but I suppose it's been building for some time. I think one of the important things to understand about it is, first, it's far from a fully developed set of technologies and so forth. Many of these technologies that we're talking about are still in development. Many of them face pretty significant hurdles in terms of being really effective, associated with intermittency, which is in the solar context, night and day, and in the wind context, is the wind blowing or not? And these relate, and then, how do you solve these problems? Well, energy storage, but that has its own set of technological challenges. And then you have, just because energy is so pervasive throughout our economic system, when you shift from carbon to renewables, the requirements are huge. They're complex, and they're very, very costly. You need to upgrade the grid and all kinds of things. And so these are big challenges. Having said that, the trends are pretty clear. It's happening. It may take time. Different people have different views about how much time it'll take. And of course, there's different elements of it. We'll move on different schedules. But it's happening. And you can see the capital flowing into renewables and so forth. People are really betting on it. You can see a lot of innovation, technological changes, and of course you can see really rapid cost reductions in some areas, like the cost of wind and the cost of solar is, solar panels and so forth is coming down quite dramatically. So these are very significant developments. So it's growing quickly. Electric vehicles are established. It's not just Tesla anymore. There's lots of companies, and they're all in on it, and there's going to be rapid growth there. And when you look throughout the broader industry and finance, you can see that energy transition is no longer on the edge. It's core strategy. And it's even core strategy for companies that you would have thought were not likely to be here at this point in time, such as Exxon. So reluctant or not, they're there. So it's no longer is energy going to energy transition and these alternative energy platforms, are they going to happen? Yes, they will. It's just a question of how quickly. So for resource-rich governments and states like Alaska, the question really is how to address, one, you participate in it, you're going to be part of it, but you also, the question is how to address the knock-on impacts of energy transition And that delicate balancing act, I guess, of how to optimize your oil and gas resources in a responsible way while transitioning to alternative energy platforms. Can we move to the next slide? This one's called Energy Transition in the Capital Markets. I won't spend a lot of time on this. It's just to really drive home the point, is that it's a very big issue, not just in the political realm and a public, you know, in the public mind. The people with the money, the people that finance investments and developments and so forth, they have grasped this thing quite firmly now. And what this slide simply tells you is that over 80 global financial institutions are restricting lending, and over 100 are divesting from fossil fuels. And there's a partial list of those, and if your eyes are good enough, you could take a look. It's not really an eye test today, so, but it's a really important development, and it's impacting everything that people in the industry are doing. So let's move forward to the next slide, which is called Oil and Gas Portfolio Restructuring Due to Energy Transition. This is something that is actually, I think, it's beginning to happen, but it's comparatively recent. Oil and gas companies are now looking at their portfolios of assets and deciding whether some of those assets should be sold or not developed because of their impact on their carbon intensity, if you like. And this is, you know, it's fairly new, and some of this, I think, is, and I don't mean to sound cynical, but some of this, there is an element of some companies selling an asset that is relatively more carbon intense to a company that doesn't care as much, and then claiming credit for it. There's that element there, but it's clear that this is something that will continue to some extent going forward, and is really going to be part of the energy transition process. So for instance, I would imagine that if you have heavy oil or viscous oil, that is you know going to be valued differently than light oil or gas or something like that. I mean, that's the kind of consideration that we're seeing now. So let's move to the next slide, which is called Decelerating Demand and the Competition for Investment Dollars. I think the impact of all the things that we've talked about, softening demand, and other impacts have created a number of trends that I think are worth mentioning. Which are going to be the dominant oil and gas producers going forward? Well, I think it's pretty clear that low cost producers will have an advantage over the higher cost producers, and this will increase over time. In this environment, they have almost universally very strong drivers to maximize production to meet budgetary requirements. They have, you know, countries like Saudi Arabia and other Middle Eastern countries have very large young populations, and their break even levels are really quite high. So they really need to produce, and I think many of those countries look at this and they say, well, they're going to try and extract as much value as they can from their oil and gas resources while they can do that. So there's those types of considerations. It makes them fairly potent competitors in the international marketplace because their costs of production are so much lower than many other producers. I think I read recently that Saudi Arabia's total costs, CapEx and OpEx, was like $9 a barrel, and And that's just a lot less than most countries can produce at. Another important feature, I think, and that we've seen, and we've talked about it already, but is the impact of shale oil in the U.S. It has been, and I think it's going to continue to be, a fairly potent market force. The thing about shale oil is it's a kind of a short reaction type development compared to many conventional developments, which are long-term types of developments. So many of the shale oil assets, they have lots of wells. Some of them are, you know, almost inventoried, and that when prices increase, they can bring those wells online to meet the demand. What this tends to do is makes them quite a nimble competitor, and it tends to restrain prices, control prices going up. So it's an important feature. I think that this is going to impact the market long term. And I guess the biggest thing and the most meaningful thing is that decelerating demand and this price environment we're seeing is just ultimately going to mean that there's less upstream investment overall from today going forward, you know, through to 2050. And I think the ones that are the hardest, maybe hardest hit, are the really big investments, long lead time investments, because that it requires companies to take a really very sharp look at the risks that they're taking, because they're having to invest so much over such a long time to get back their money. So when you look at this from the perspective of oil and gas producing countries and states such as Alaska, I think a key learning is that the competition for investment dollars and for the expertise and capacity that the oil companies bring is going to be quite fierce, and it's just going to get fiercer as we go forward. Oil and gas companies, you know, they're under pressure, and they are going to have to answer to their shareholders and investors. And that means they're going to be requiring projects to meet fairly high hurdles for profitability and return. And it's not like the old days. It seemed like in the old days that almost any project could get, meet its financial investment decision requirement. That's no longer true. Projects are being looked at very hard by companies, and a lot of projects aren't getting done. I think another thing that's quite important to keep in mind is that, many oil and gas projects are quite long-term. And so the oil and gas, the decisions that oil and gas companies are making today about whether to be present in a country, whether to do a project or not to do a project, are really decisions that will have an impact for the next 20, 30 years, and really are kind of fundamental to whether oil and gas assets get monetized. It's that's the nature of this business. The decisions today are going to be impacting over the next 20 or 30 years. Okay, so if we could move to the next slide, which talks about what are governments doing to try and address some of these issues. Many governments have taken some proactive steps as the market conditions have changed, especially when it's particularly steep and sharp price declines that are having a real dislocation, such as we've seen in 2014, 2015, and 2020 with the COVID oil price war kind of events. And they take a number of different types of actions to try and soften the blow and to keep people investing, keep drilling wells, keep keep production going, keep investment programs going. A lot of them are tax related. They're accelerating depreciation, those kinds of actions you've seen in places such as Norway, tax rate reductions such as we've seen in the United Kingdom. These are things that are responses that many countries are taking in these environments. Many of them are structured to be temporary. In other words, when things level out, then these incentives are reduced. But I think it's all just a feature of needing to recognize that if they don't take some actions, that it can be the impact, the long-term impact on the activities in their oil and gas sector can be impacted. Another point about this, I think, is that any fiscal change takes time. It often takes time to implement, legislatively, but also the effect of it. It's felt over years, and it's part of, a broad set of impacts that need to be assessed. Okay, so now we can talk a little bit about Alaska.
Mike, let's see if we have any questions from committee members. Do we have any questions?
Sure.
Yeah, Senator Michiki.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. A few years ago, the big battle cry for those hoping to expedite the alternative and renewable options were in this leave it in the ground philosophy. It seems to me like leaving it in the ground for future value that may likely not be there. Is that philosophy dead, or is that something you're still seeing spread around the globe?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that one, future generations type arguments, and save it for the future. I haven't heard it much recently, and I think that that probably that perspective has changed, and for most people, or is changing as we're talking, because the future is looking different now, and I think the converse is probably true. It is, how do you monetize your assets in a sensible way, and take advantage of them while you can.
Yes, Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Yes, I think that Mr. Klein commented on the slide 10, decelerating demand, by basically saying the goal for Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries potentially could be to extract as much value as possible from their oil and gas resources while they can. So it sounds to me it's like there might be a recognition that the pivot to alternatives, I think you said also, it's not a matter of if but when, and so the when time frame is unknown, and I think that perhaps there could be a supply glut, I suppose, if their companies trying to flood the market to get as much value as they can within the next 10, maybe 15 years, and maybe as high as 20 years, which goes by fast when you look at horizons here, financial planning. And so you basically stated that you're supporting Senator Michiki's statement. Is that pretty much correct on slide 10?
I think that's correct. Yeah, I think his statement is absolutely correct. I also think that it's as you pointed out, there are supply-demand issues that have to be dealt with, and you can see the OPEC plus countries trying to deal with them, and it's really challenging. It's challenging because it requires human beings to agree with each other who don't necessarily have the same interests. It's challenging because it's also very complex to try and forecast supply and demand at that level. So, yes, they're trying to do that, but I think their ultimate goal is to to take as much advantage as they can of their resources while they can.
Thanks, Mike. I have a question or just a clarification. So everything that I've seen you mention here all seem to be sort of negative impacts on producers, it seems, globally. And in the last slide, you mentioned that it's common, it's written here that it's common for proactive governments to reassess existing fiscal terms in order to consider initiatives and to ensure continued exploration and development. So is what you're saying there that other states and governments are trying to incentivize increases in production? Because the bill in front of us increases taxes, and so that's kind of what we're looking at. What are the impacts in the industry? And it sounds like there's not too many folks out there that are doing that.
I think that some of these things are ways of incentivizing investment. So if you accelerate depreciation or allow immediate recapture of costs, as you've seen, for instance, in Norway, that encourages people to make investments that they might be reluctant to otherwise take. And so in a sense, it's just another kind of a measure like that. So there's just a lot of different techniques, really, that you can use to try and get people to keep busy and keep invested. I think what you've done in Alaska is one of them, and what you see in other countries are different types of measures.
Okay, yeah, so you're saying it's a little bit more difficult now to keep people busy and invested. That's kind of what I figured. We have a question from Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Klein, for being here. Just a really quick question. There was a slide dealing with some of the it's titled Energy Transition in an issue for markets, and then it mentions like Bank of America, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, just either divesting or restricting lending to the Arctic drilling. And that's been happening for several years now. I'm just curious if your thoughts are that they're doing that because it looks risky or riskier to do business or to basically invest in Arctic drilling, or because what are the factors that would go into those decisions made at that level when it comes to financial institutions?
Well, that's a really, really good question. And I can't say that I know exactly what is on their mind. But it's true that Arctic drilling is more difficult, it's more challenging, and it's costly. And at a time when there is lots of different assets you can look at that may be available at a reasonable price, you have to question whether where you should put your money, I guess, is the other question. But I think as well, and that the concerns about the environmental concerns, I guess, feature to some degree and probably to an increasing degree over time as we've gone forward. But it's a good question. I'm not sure I have a really good answer for you, but I think it's probably a mix of financial and other considerations.
Right, and then just a follow-up. If Mr. Klein, if we were to change tax policy here in the state of Alaska, where it was much, much more favorable, at what point would lenders, if they are actually just looking at the economics of it, say, okay, Alaska is a great place to invest, or a much, much better place to invest? It's been a while since we've had the Fraser Institute present here about what they found internationally. But are there things? I guess if it's part of your presentation later on, we can hear about it too. But do they look at that as far as taxation policy when it comes to their decisions to make decisions on Arctic drilling and whether they divest or not?
I think that companies definitely look at tax policy as an important consideration as to whether to invest, whether it's in the Arctic or anywhere else. Is it the only thing they look at? No, of course not. I mean, the first thing they look at is the rock. Does it look good as a resource? But as you move forward, you say, is the subsurface good? Yes. What are the difficulties on the surface? And yes, of course, in the Arctic, and you have some challenges there too. And then, you know, you move down the kind of chain, the economic chain, and very soon you get to tax policy. And tax policy makes a difference. It's not the only thing. And sometimes it's hard to know whether a particular tax provision was the dominant effect for a decision or not. But we know. I mean, we've known for many years that tax policy makes a difference in how companies approach things and can improve an investment environment or make it worse if it's not done correctly.
And just and can I just sort of restate it? When it comes to lenders for capital markets, you know, the folks that I mentioned have divested or are restricting for Arctic, do they look down that far when it comes to economic policies for our state? Do they actually say, well, geez, now it looks more favorable? So, you know, as far as our you know, we're no longer divesting in Arctic drilling. We're actually going to start reinvesting because we see it as a better investment in the long term. And that's for the capital market investors.
I think they look at where a company is investing or proposing to invest at a certain level. You know, they're investment bankers and so forth. So, you know, they look at it at a certain level, and that they have a view on whether it's a good thing to be doing. I think that maybe it's the same for the Arctic, but, you know, in the recent years we've seen at a high level view that, you know, offshore exploration, maybe that's not the thing to be investing in. I think that's changing now, but I'm just using it as an example. Maybe, you know, because it's very expensive, each well is very expensive, it's quite risky. You know, the long-term prospects for the industry are, you know, uncertain and all that kind of thing. And so there's this kind of high-level view that the companies that are heavily oriented that way are perhaps a higher risk. And I think that's the kind of level that financial companies will look at. So if a company was really focused on Arctic drilling, I think they would look at that. I don't know exactly what they would conclude, but I think they would look at it and say, this company seems to be doing a great thing, or maybe overweighted in a particular area. And it's that kind of consideration I think you see.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Klein. If you could please continue your presentation.
Okay. So, if we can move to the slide titled Alaska's Oil and Gas Sector is Maturing and Facing Headwinds. For many years, of course, Alaska has been a really fantastic place to do business for oil and gas companies. As I said, they have fantastic, you know, attractive resources and at scale. They have access to a very good market. They have a very skilled workforce and a deep service company base. All of these are the kind of the ingredients, if you like, for a very successful business. I mean, having said that, obviously in recent years things have been more challenging. For Alaska. They have some of their biggest assets like Prudhoe Bay are becoming quite mature. They're still producing at a good level, but they're producing far less than they used to produce. They have new assets that are very interesting, but putting those into, you know, going through the whole process of you know, development and production has not always been straightforward, and I guess I'm thinking of the Willow as a recent and prominent example of that. It's not that it's not going to happen, but it's being challenged. And of course, Alaska is a high-cost environment, and because of, you know, the seasons and the short time window for activities because of the weather, it's a, you know, challenging and relatively high-cost operating environment. So those are some of the things it's facing now. And of course, it's also facing just the same general global headwinds that are being felt by the industry generally of price volatility and accelerating demand. So it's got a set of things that it's is dealing with. And I think that the our view, I guess, of the per barrel tax credit that and it's since it became law, there appears to have been a kind of stabilization of the production decline. So our view is that some of the things that you've done have actually seem to have been effective. It's not that we've analyzed it in great financial depth or anything like that, but it's just an impression from looking and understanding what we see out there. Let's go to the next slide, which is titled Maturing Assets. This really is just to drive home the point about what's changing in Alaska. And I think you probably know this pretty well, but some very, very big assets that were producing, you know, 2 million a day in the 80s are, you know, much less than that now. That, of course, is having a big impact because you've got less production, and at the same time we're dealing with price declines. But despite all of that, I mean, it's still very healthy, and it provides very substantial revenues to the state. But you know, there's been an impact, and I think it's very notable. If we can move to the next slide. And it's called Sustaining Petroleum Revenues for Alaska. So the question is, when you have a maturing industry, but you also have good resources generally, the question is, how do you go about sustaining your petroleum revenues? So if you're going to offset crude oil production declines, there's two things that you need to do, and we've seen this actually in the UK and the North Sea to some extent as well. You need to take care of the assets you do have, and you need to nurture them and do everything you can to extend the life of those assets so they continue to produce and deliver. But at the same time, you have to develop new projects. And without those new projects, you can't fill the gap of the maturing projects that is left by maturing projects. So this is extremely important if you're going to sustain the economy and all the jobs that go with the oil and gas sector. I think it's another point to consider is that, yes, you're going through a kind of a transformation to alternative energy platforms, and that's going to be going on for some time. But it's expensive, it's costly, and I think that the oil business, oil revenues will be the thing that you use to subsidize the costs of this transition to alternative energy platforms. So it's important from that perspective as well. And when we look at some of the things out there currently today, we see the Willow Project as being a great example of a very important project. It's, you know, a lot of investment, but it's bringing, you know, thousands of construction jobs and hundreds of permanent jobs if it goes forward. And it's going to be, you know, a real contributor to filling that gap we've been talking about with, you know, 600,000 barrels a day produce. I mean, 600 a million barrels of resource producing at 160,000 barrels equivalent a day. I mean, this is very impressive, and it's important. Of course, we know that at the moment it's got some approvals that needs to sort out. Another example is the Repsol Oil Search Pikka project, which is another kind of project. It is big, it's expensive, and if it achieves its objectives, will make a big contribution towards filling that gap. But you know, the kinds of companies that do those projects are typically well financed or larger companies that have a tolerance for risk. So you need to keep attracting those kinds of companies. If we can move to the next slide, titled "Protecting the Petroleum Tax Base and the Economy." So we talked about the fact that petroleum-related revenues are an important contributor to Alaska's economy, and that they are under some pressure as the industry changes, and we have energy transition, increasing asset maturity, and all the other factors we've discussed. And to sustain those revenues and the jobs that come with them, Alaska needs to attract oil and gas companies, as many as they can, and not large ones, and all the way to small ones, because they all take a different role in the sector, and you need all of those different kinds of companies to be able to explore, develop, and produce, and sustain your resources and your production. So assets like Willow and Pikka, they're needed, and you need large companies typically to do that. You've got mature assets as well, and you need companies that are really focused on that. And that's something that we saw in the North Sea a lot, that when the big companies moved out, you had smaller companies and some larger companies like Apache, but smaller companies moved in that were able to move more quickly and had a lower cost base and were able to kind of squeeze value out of those assets. It's very important to have those kinds of companies involved as well. But attracting these companies is a competitive activity. You're in a competition with everybody else that is trying to attract those companies. As one of the questions you asked, but is the tax burden important? Yes, it is. Overall costs are important as well. So let's then move on to the slide titled Senate Bill 3002 and the per barrel credit. So the per barrel credit is a sliding scale tax credit against the producer's tax liability for each barrel of taxable oil. And it's a very in its principle it's quite straightforward. It's designed to offer a higher tax credit in a lower oil price environment, which makes sense. You're trying to keep people motivated and willing to work and invest and so forth. But of course, as you get into higher price environments, the credit reduces or goes away entirely. We understand this amendment is intended to reduce that tax credit. We haven't studied, modeled this, as you probably need to do to understand in detail how it might impact. I would just note that it is very important to do that and because how you set that credit is going to be quite important to kind of maintain the interests in these assets and to avoid deterring investments and activities. So we're not saying that we know the answers to exactly, we haven't modeled this, but we think it's an important area. If we can move to the next slide, which is called Tax Policy Considerations. So Alaska's strategy to extract more revenues from the oil and gas sector, we'll need to consider not only the near-term revenue capture objectives, which are obviously extremely important, but also try to understand what the medium and long-term impacts will be on oil and gas development and the related tax base. I want to make sure that whatever tax policy that is implemented is not going to discourage companies from taking on these big investment step change type developments that we've talked about that, you know, involve a lot of capital, people and resources, but that are key to replacing declining revenues from existing fields. It's also important to make sure they don't discourage, you know, companies, you know, existing companies or even new entrants that are focused on optimizing your mature fields and getting the most out of those and extending their lives and their productive lives. So all of these, you know, and they're different kinds of companies and they may not, you know, they may not have the same sensitivities, if you like, but all of them need to be kind of in the frame as you think through your tax policy. You know, the global experience is, I think, quite clear that if you do make taxes punitive or too high, it can encourage companies to exit, or maybe even if they can't exit, to just run down the asset, harvest it, if you like, so that they, you know, make it minimal investment, so to speak, while extracting the maximum out of the existing asset. Obviously, it will encourage companies that are looking at investing to potentially seek out other more tax-friendly jurisdictions. And all of this, of course, would, if it happens, would contribute to reduced investment and activity and to further production declines in the future. So, you know, it's a very challenging thing, and it's very difficult, but tax policy has to be crafted and in some ways nuanced to support revenue capture and to maintain a healthy, you know, robust participation across all the different asset types that Alaska has. And if we can move on to the next slide, I think that's the final slide. So, you know, we've been asked the question about, well, what do we think about the existing tax credit and what it might mean for Alaska? Well, you know, obviously, we've said this before and repeat that, you know, you've got to get the right balance between revenue capture and keeping a healthy, vibrant oil and gas sector that is really competitive with other countries around the world. And is Alaska competitive? I think it's a complicated question, and there's many different things that influence whether a country is competitive. But my feeling is that it is. I think, you know, one of the indicators is that, you know, Alaska was in a fairly steady decline for quite a number of years. But after MAPA, it seems to have stabilized. And I'm not saying, I want to just be clear, that there's lots of different things going on at the same time. It's not just about tax policy. But I read into that MAPA's impact was positive. And we see also, of course, at the same time that not only a production level steady, but you have companies coming in and like Hilcorp taking over large mature assets. And you're seeing companies that are willing to invest in the really big projects like Willow and Pikka. And I think that's positive as well. So my takeaway from it is that it seems competitive at the present time. But I think it's important, as you know, as a final point, to note that, you know, this thing is of competitiveness is not given. It's something that needs to be constantly reevaluated, because the competitive landscape changes constantly, and so you have to, you know, you keep your eye on it, you keep analyzing it, and you may have to make adjustments upwards and maybe downwards, whatever, as you go forward to make sure that you have the right balance so that you capture the revenues that you need to capture for the state, while at the same time providing that kind of support for exploration, development, and production of your key oil and gas resources. That is, I think, our final slide. I just want to open it up for questions.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Klein. We have a question from Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So, Mr. Klein, thank you very much for this presentation. And we are, just to kind of give you a quick timeline with us, we're currently in special session, which ends tomorrow night. Our normal session starts generally the middle of January. So we'll have, 3.5 months or so between now and then. I suspect that this concept, whether this bill remains, the concept I'm sure will remain. And so as the LB&A chair, I'm wearing a second hat here, I do hope that some of these last slides you pose questions. What is Alaska's position in the global market? We may need help to determine the economics of production with a potential change in taxes on the sliding scale. I think that's one of the things that would be really helpful in the next 3 months, if you could explore and drill down a little bit further. So if and when we bring you back again, either in this capacity here or in another capacity with another committee, you can be prepared, your company can be prepared to say, well, we've done our due diligence and here's kind of what could happen, or this is what our analysis shows us. So I just putting it out there that we appreciate you giving this overview, but perhaps a more in-depth in 3 or 4 months might be asked for.
Absolutely, and it is the kind of thing that we do focus on as a consultancy in different places around the world, and I think it is important, and we will definitely look at it.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
Yeah, Mr. Klein, I don't know if this is a product that's available, but have you studied like a schedule of replacement? I mean, what proportion is replaced by renewables? What will remain in demand for manufacturing, plastics, air, railroad, shipping, remote energy? What does that look like? I mean, at what point are we in harvest mode anyway? Is there someone who has studied sort of what that model looks like as innovation and renewable energy efficiency has improved and the costs have come down?
I think people are studying it as we speak. And recently I was looking at an EIA study, and they look at different scenarios because there's so much uncertainty as to how things will happen in reality. And what they do is they look at different scenarios, which is, a low cost solar scenario, a high cost solar scenario, a high supply, high oil and gas supply, low oil and gas, those kinds of different scenarios. And they look at a high level, they look at therefore what the relative mix will be on energy supplies, whether it will be more solar and less oil and gas, or more oil and gas, and of course coal and nuclear as well. These studies are out there, and I think they're helpful and they're important, but there is still a lot of uncertainty out there, and I think the best you can really do is try and understand those different cases, if you like, and what's driving them, and use that to inform your judgment, and it'll change. Those cases and will change as we get down the road. At the moment, the spread of uncertainty is pretty wide.
Follow up.
Yes, follow up.
Yeah, just as a follow up, is in our special case in Alaska, we'd have to plug in the cost and availability of capital from companies that are unwilling to invest in the Arctic, and the same diminished demand elsewhere, right? Because you don't only have the replacement of renewables, you have the unwillingness for traditional funding organizations to invest in the state. How do you sort of plug that in to look at an end game for oil and gas in Alaska?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it may be that when you look at the impact of, you know, these kind of global trends in finance and investment, and what those institutions and what therefore companies are willing to do, and maybe it just drives you towards the things that you can do. You can optimize your existing assets. You can pick conventional projects that are perceived not to be crossing any of those lines that have been drawn by the financial institutions. I suppose it's if you know Arctic exploration is disfavored, I'm not sure what you can do about that, other than focus on the things that work for you. But it's probably not a very satisfactory answer, but that's what I can think of at the moment.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to acknowledge Representative Tarr, who's been with us for the whole hearing. I missed you earlier. Thank you for joining us, Rep. Tarr. Yes, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm inclined to agree with Senator von Imhoff that we definitely need some detailed analysis. I'll never forget when the current tax policy we have was still a bill. A BP rep, they're not in Alaska anymore, I can use their name, right? A BP rep sat at the end of the Senate Finance table and said, it's nice, but it wouldn't go far enough to attract any meaningful investment, and if it passed, it wouldn't change the decline curve from the previous 7 years. Today we're hearing a very different story. So, Mr. Klein, I know you haven't done in-depth modeling. Do you have a general sense, though, in terms of competitiveness, how much does this bill move the needle on Alaska's mature fields?
The existing MAPA or the proposed amendments?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. The proposed amendments.
I don't really have a view because we haven't studied it. But the only thing I would say is, if you have something in place that you think is working, before changing it, you'd want to assess it very carefully. That's all I think I would say to that. I'm not sure I'm in a position to give anything more precise.
And just so everybody knows, thank you, Mr. Klein. This is very spur of the moment, I guess. We very much appreciate your work on short notice. We had two simple questions. One was, is it getting more expensive and more difficult to produce given the economic environment in the North Slope? And two, what are the considerations for Alaska as it relates to tax policy? So these are pretty broad, and I completely agree. Like Senator von Imhoff said, there are some things that the idea behind this presentation is to find things that we really need to drill into to get specifics. And so I appreciate that, Senator Keel. Other questions? Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate your comments, Mr. Klein. It's been great to hear. Can you put us in perspective to the rest of the world, the other global partners, people who are producing oil around the world? Are we in a worse position than they are? Are we in a reasonably the same position? I mean, we have a big factor for us is the cost of transportation, the pipeline, and at some point, the less oil you put through that pipeline, the costlier it is. So can you sort of compare us to globally?
I mean, as I said earlier, in a global sense, we think the winner is the low cost low all-in cost producers. And it's quite clear that the lowest all-in cost producers are in the Middle East. Their costs are just so much lower than everybody else. And so they're dominant competitors. But when you look beyond that, you have in the lower 48, you have some pretty significant competition from especially from the shale oil and everything, and they don't have the same transportation costs as you pointed out that Alaska has. I still think Alaska's, you know, fairly well positioned in many respects, but the competition's out there, and it's important to you know, recognize the challenges you have, and whether it's transportation or anything else, but and try and calibrate your overall delivery in terms of tax policy and so forth to try and meet that. Is that helpful, or does that answer your question?
No, I think it does. Thank you. I appreciate your thoughts.
Yes, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the description of the charge to our presenter today. That helps me understand why we had so much discussion of the new fields on a bill that really only taxes particularly the mature fields. But I guess combined with Senator Stevens' question, it does lead me to ask, Mr. Klein, can you talk to us a little bit about the role of prospectivity, of the geology, in figuring out that competitive position? You talked about all-in cost. I mean, I assume that's not a total dollar amount. That's a per barrel or a you know, per profit. So where does Alaska stand, and how exactly does that fit into the puzzle?
Prospectivity? I think it's always the most important thing. You know, when an oil and gas company is looking at something, if the rock doesn't work, they won't do it. It doesn't matter what you offer them. They just won't do it. So I think, you know, Alaska has attractive resources. Some of them are mature, but that doesn't mean they're not attractive. I think that's a positive for Alaska. It's the things after that I think, you know, are become more difficult. You have a difficult operating environment. You have the transportation costs. You have all of this constant trying to get the balance right on your taxes and so forth. All of those things are additional things. I think your resources are pretty good.
All right. Again, Mr. Klein, thank you for presenting, especially given the short notice. Thanks to everybody for being available during this busy time and special session. Alaska's tax policy and revenues is very topical in the legislature right now. I plan to have additional hearings and further analyze the impacts ahead of the next regular session and potentially during any sessions in between. The meeting is now adjourned at 4:40 p.m.